Welcome to The Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal industry. I'm Marlene Gebauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert. So this week we have a just star-studded episode with some we got some power players in the legal technology industry, especially when it comes to practical uses of products like OpenAI's GPT-4 for everything from legal research to how to scope your legal work.
We are so happy to welcome back our longtime friend Pablo Arredondo from Case Text, who is actually our second guest on the show and with whom we've talked about practical uses on AI and legal for more than 3 years now. So Pablo, it is very good to have you back.
Great to be back.
So we also have Evan Schenkman, Chief Knowledge and Innovation Officer at Fisher Phillips, who has teamed up with Case Text and their co-counsel product. Hey, Evan, thank you very much for coming in and joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And to round out our panel, we asked Darth Vaughn, litigation counsel and legal innovation and technology operations lead at Ford Motor Company, to join us as well. So, Darth, it's great to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So we really do have a trifecta here of in-house legal, outside legal, legal vendors, all aligned to bring some practical AI tools to rapidly change how we're practicing and delivering legal services. So Pablo, let me start off with you. Like we mentioned in the introductions, we have been having discussions about AI and legal research for years now. It goes back really 5 years that you and I and Marlene have been talking about it. But it seems like the last 6 months has just been an AI frenzy. It's so much so that even the legal industry has joined in on the frenzy. And you know it's got to be quite a frenzy for the legal to just jump in. So let me ask you, how did your years of preparation position you to essentially be the first to the market with a generative AI product for legal when you launch CoCounsel?
Yeah, absolutely. It has been a pretty crazy time. I'd like to think that it was the panel that Evan and I did at ILTA that caused this national, awareness of AI and these large language models. Perhaps there were some other factors, I'm not sure. Like you said, we've been working with these large language models from their inception. And there's a few ways that it's been very helpful for us as we've now kind of start to harness this next generation of AI. First, as we can get into a little more detail, you can't just necessarily use these new models on their own, right? You need to actually couple them to something real. And there's a whole area called retrieval augmented generation where you essentially couple an AI to a search engine. And once you start doing that, it's how good is your search engine? And so a lot of the work we did with earlier models and with creating something called parallel search, which you guys know about, we were basically using earlier language models to be much better at retrieving the relevant information. So that fits hand in hand then with, some of our most exciting features with CoCounsel, which let attorneys use that approach to do legal research and kind of research analysis, to do fact discovery and things like that. And then we were also aware of the pitfalls and some of the dangers and the way that these models can, misbehave if you're not putting guidelines on them. And I think that's really important. Frankly, also our earlier work with this led us, we would partner with firms like Fisher Phillips and do sort of development on, a lot of the earlier models, some of which worked better than others. And so I think we just had a lot of experience and dexterity kind of what does it mean to try these things and to experiment it and to do that. So, there's been a number of things that K6 has had. We've been quite privileged, actually, to have a number of these different things come together. And then, of course, being, approached by OpenAI late last year, and shown GPT-4 before, anybody, very, very early on, all the work we had done with previous models kind of let us be very prepared to realize just how big a gain this was and to just go all in on it when we saw it. So I think a number of factors came together, both luck and, some virtue. As always, there's a mix of those things.
Well, yeah, I think you make your own luck. And I've mentioned this in previous episodes that, this is not a Case Text advertisement here, but you guys tend to come up with very innovative ideas, real outside the box kind of things. So much so, and we joke that once you create something, it motivates all the other legal vendors to be copycats on that. So I mean, you're obviously doing something right.
Keep talking, Greg. Keep talking. Continue.
Just like Greg, keep talking. So Pablo, I like that you were talking about how you know, there's sort of different testing, and some things work and some things don't. And, you know, I want to pass the ball to Evan, because I know that you both work together. So, you know, Evan, can you share Fisher Phillips' experience of partnering with Case Text and using CoCounsel? You know, sort of, again, sort of what was that process like for you, and how has this impacted your firm on how they approach the way they research and practice law?
Yeah, happy to have that conversation. So we've been working with Case Text now for years and years. I've been working with them for, you know, several firms I've been at, and they've always sort of been ahead of the game in terms of what they've been doing in using large language models and using this technology. And I know you've sort of mentioned that Pablo keeps coming up with things that other folks have to try to copy. Sometimes he comes up with these harebrained ideas that don't work, and that's fun too. But it's been so much fun being able to work with them over the years with, you know, various ideas and projects and concepts that really have turned into amazing things that help our attorneys do things better, smarter, faster. And so I guess it was late fall, and I was coaching a soccer game, and I got a phone call literally while I was on the field from Pablo saying, you know, Evan, forget everything we ever did. Forget everything you've ever known. Something really, really, really extraordinary is happening, but I can't tell you what it is. So that started on this journey over the past number of months now, where, and this is before ChatGPT came out, where the world got to see the possibility of generative AI. This is back when we were, knew about large language models, and we were using them in things like parallel search, but never something nearly this sophisticated. So at that point, we had the privilege of being able to work with Case Text and see CoCounsel in beta and help train those skills and help put it in the hands of some of our attorneys who are beta testing it, and really seeing the value of what this really can do in an attorney's day-to-day life, making their lives easier, helping them focus on the better aspects of practicing law, helping them get to the answer in a better way, in a smarter way, in a more appropriate way. So that was sort of before we could ever talk about it. Now that it's actually live and launched, our firm is using it. They're using it every day in what they do. So they're using it for legal research. And I could talk in greater detail about how they're doing that. Your users probably know sort of how that works, but essentially you can just ask it a question in plain English, and then it will generate a research memo for you. It will review cases, statutes, regulations, up to date. It'll give you a research memo. It will cite its sources. It will give you an analysis. It will pull from various places. And our attorneys are really blown away by that component of it. We've had attorneys, you know, some of our more senior attorneys have begrudgingly tried it out because they want to prove that it's not good and it's not right, and that, you know, they will never be able to come up with something that's as good as what they can come up with on their own. And it does a fantastic job, and they're sort of converted now. And they told me, you know, there are some things that I still can add to it. I still have aspects of my practice where I know the attorneys that I'm working with, I know the judge, there are certain nuances, but it gives them a fantastic starting point to get them to the answer in a better, smarter, more appropriate way. And they're now, they now love it. There are some attorneys who say they have never, for years now, they haven't done their own legal research. They've given it to associates, or they knew the answer, but now they're starting to use this tool. So it's sort of making this whole research phase of a case more approachable to attorneys, whether they're junior attorneys or super senior attorneys, and they love it. So we're using it for research. We're using it for document review and analysis. So when we're preparing for summary judgment, when we have maybe not a lot of time to review thousands of documents before we have to provide a response to a TRO, it's coming in handy. We're able to upload those, ask questions, ask for it to let us know where in the documents somebody might have talked about a particular key point in a case or a key point in the fact pattern. So it's very helpful for that. We're using it for summarizing. There's a summarize skill that's terrific for things like deposition transcripts. We've had clients over the years that say, you know, why should it take this many hours to do a dep summary? It's a summary of a dep transcript. Is there any way to do that better? This tool helps you do things like that better. So there really are aspects from day one to, you know, preparing for a trial, where this is coming in handy now. And it's only been about 2 months since this went launched live, but our attorneys are really using it in the day-to-day workflow, and they're finding it terrific.
That's amazing. And, you know, I imagine those skeptics you mentioned that have turned and into believers are probably your best evangelists.
They now are. we just got back from our partner get-together over the past weekend, and it's amazing how many people came up to me and said, you know, I didn't believe you. I didn't believe it would be that good, but it really is. And we actually had one partner who was one of those folks that said, this can't be that good. The partners, when they're going to these retreats, they get an email with 10 or 15 articles saying, you know, a couple of the sessions, it would be great if you read these articles beforehand to get up to speed with whatever it is. And one of the partners replied all to and said, I ran all these articles through CoCounsel. If you want to read summaries of all of them before you read the articles, here you go. And a lot of thank yous to that reply all. But it just shows that now that they are starting to use this technology, they're seeing other ways to use it. They're incorporating it into their daily workflows, and they're better for it.
Well, Darth, you've listened to the stories, and I'm sure this is not the first time you've heard how lawyers are adjusting their normal workflow to using, you know, these AI technologies. So, yeah, and you have a unique perspective as, you know, being on the buying side of legal services. So what are your expectations now, both internally for your own legal department and externally for your outside counsel, on how you think that, you know, they need to address legal work when they have tools like this now?
Yeah, well, I've been on all sides of this equation, so I'm sensitive to all of that. I'll say this. I think there is a lot of fear that the technology is going to replace lawyers. And my position is it's not going to replace lawyers. It's going to enhance lawyers. It's a tool to make us work better. And I'm envious that I didn't have this tool when I was outside counsel practicing and trying cases, because I feel like practicing would have been a better experience. This is going to replace tasks. It's not going to replace lawyers. We are still going to be at the helm using our subject matter expertise and domain knowledge to make a better outcome for our clients. Lawyers are not single-purpose lawyers. They are versatile people who want to solve problems. And my expectation is that this will help us get away from some of the the drudgery work, the repetitive tasks that we didn't enjoy doing, and replace that with highest and better uses, where we become the problem solvers that we always sought to be in this profession. I don't know that it changes buying at this point. It's still very, very new. But I do see a day coming where the expectation for certain things will change. My expectation, to Evan's point, for how long a deposition summary should take is going to change because of this technology. My expectation in terms of how quickly you can give me an answer back is going to change because of this technology. And it's weird. I've been in AI since 2017. This is the first time that I feel like the technology has finally caught up with the words, and we actually have the tools to allow us to take advantage of where we are from a technical standpoint. So I'm excited.
So Evan talked a little bit about, well, actually, Evan talked a lot about research and how and how CoCounsel.
Like research. You know.
Research is great.
It is.
It is. We like it too. But so he talked a lot about how CoCounsel can help the research process, and Pablo hinted a little bit at guardrails and things like that. So I want to make the question a little bit broader to the entire group and say, let's discuss the benefits and drawbacks or things to be aware of when using AI tools like GPT-4 in the legal research process. If somebody's looking to say, hey, I'm listening to this podcast and this CoCounsel thing seems pretty interesting. What can we say? What are the key points that they need to be kind of focused on? And I'm going to look at my screen. I'm going to go with Pablo first because you're on top.
I think the most important thing to start with is the difference between asking the model on its own for anything, where what you'll get is an answer that seems very believable, but as I think is sort of now becoming hopefully common knowledge, could be completely fabricated. When I first interacted with GPT-4, I asked it about a case I worked on, and its answer was so believable that I was second guessing myself. I was like, God, did we argue that? I don't think we did, but man, And then I typed it and said, you're wrong, I worked on this case. And I kid you not, it came back and said, Pablo, you can sit there and brag about the cases you worked on, but I'm right. And here's my proof. And then it did a URL to nowhere, a URL right. That went nowhere. So, and I say this lovingly, left to their own devices, they're just little sociopaths. I'm sorry. You just can't use it that way. And so I think one of the most important things to really get across to everyone is using the model just on its own with the public API. It's not secure. You might be donating your data. You're going to see hallucinations. It's really not a good idea at all. And That is very different, though, than using it in a system built from the ground up to ameliorate all of those concerns, right? So one where the servers are secure, where you're not donating your data to the model, where you're using this retrieval augmented generation to anchor it to something real. So if I had like one sort of headline, it would be to not let the horror stories about using the public system deter you from really taking a look at and evaluating systems that were built to work for lawyers. As always, you have to suffer through my analogies. It's just the part and parcel of bringing me anywhere. It'd be like, to me, ChatGPT as though a society had never seen cars before, and suddenly cars arrived, but all they did was donuts on the lawn and then do 90 in reverse on the freeway or something like that. And it's like, wow, look at these cars. They're amazing. But of course, a lot of folks are like, I don't know about those cars. I prefer it, right? So to that end, right, just the proper, responsible, reliable use of these models is possible. You just have to be using a system built for that. And that's emphatically not the public one.
Pablo, I'm going to ask you the impossible. Can you just vary in like telling a second grader, how is it that when I ask co-counsel a question that may have sensitive information in it, how does that not get to OpenAI?
Right. So there's sort of getting to OpenAI, which is to say being exposed to, sorry, you said second grader. Okay. let's see. So let's
write
say
it,
you
write it in crayon.
Gave your, right. Let's say you gave your homework to the teacher and they just wrote a grade on it and then gave it back to you. And they didn't keep your homework and they didn't do anything else with your homework, right? That's the secure system. The other system is if the teacher were to take your homework and add it to a big collection of papers that they're then doing, that's then available to everybody. And that's what, you know, understandably from the viewpoint of these companies like OpenAI that are looking for training data, right? That's how you can build better models. So it's understandable why they do it in some instances, but it's simply not something that lawyers can do. I hope that worked.
Okay.
I thought that was really good. Evan, what do you have to say?
Sure. So as for the benefits and drawbacks of AI tools like GPT-4, I'll talk. Pablo already mentioned, and I think we talked about the problems with just a native GPT-4 application that hasn't been trained, the hallucinations and it's stale and the trustworthiness and the security and all that. So I'll talk about the risks of using co-counsel or something that has been trained for legal, because I think that still is important for attorneys and people in firms and law departments to still think about. You need to realize that it is not an artificial lawyer. This isn't something where we can ask it a question and say, okay, we got our answer, we're good to go. I'm just going to go and file it, or I'm just going to go and tell my client, take legal action based upon it. It's a starting point. It's a tool to help our attorneys do things and get to the answer in a better, more direct way. You still need to, if you're using the research skill, it's great, but we still need to research and read those cases and make sure the case does help our client out, right? Because there always is nuance in those cases. But it gets us to the point where we know which cases to read and which passages to read much more quickly. We're learning that prompt engineering is very important, right? That's making sure that you ask the AI tool, co-counsel, or any other tool, it in the best way, providing enough facts and information to help it find the answer, right? And we have attorneys who are letting me know that, we asked the question and we got an answer that was sort of there, or documents were retrieved that were sort of there, but then we asked it in a different way, and then we got exactly what we were looking for, right? That prompt engineering, we'll get better at it over time. We, the attorneys and the users, but it's a skill set, and it's a skill that that people will need to learn and get better at. And I'm sure there'll be best practices over time that are developed to make sure that the prompts that we give these systems get us what we're looking for.
Evan, one of the things before you go on, I just wanted to ask you real quickly. One of the things I'm finding with the prompt engineering is that, and like you said, it's a different skill set. Are you finding your attorneys or librarians or researchers or paralegals?
Oh, you stole my question.
Oh, sorry. Are they?
You stole my follow up, man.
Go ahead. Are they adjusting? Are they? Can you teach old dogs new tricks? Kind of thing.
You can, and I think it's easier with this tool than with predecessor legal technology in general, because the whole way this tool and those like it are set up is it's in a conversational way. So I think what we're seeing initially is that people ask the questions in a too terse fashion. They might have asked the question without providing any facts or any detail or any other information. And within reason, the more information you provide to this tool in asking your question, the more it has to go on. So I think people are picking that up over time. We tried to make that point when we rolled it out, but I think you sort of need to be in the tool and using the tool in order to get and see the results that come out in order to have it really hit them in the face that, yep, that really does make a difference. I mean, I think people are getting better at it, but it's a learning process.
All right, so I'm going to follow up with a follow-up. Do you find that people who have been trained in say, you know, doing natural language searches or Boolean types of searches, you know, who are familiar with search languages, do you find that they take to it more readily or not?
Hey, can I jump in on this one?
Because
yes. I'm actually looking at this right now.
Good.
Well, if you have an experienced, you know, tactician with the traditional platforms, they have to readjust the way they've learned how to do searches. And it's a very difficult habit to break. You're no longer looking for keywords. You're looking for concepts, right? This understands the semantics around what you're asking. So if you're trying to adjust from the world where, all right, I'm going to toss in, you know, this range of keywords and, you know, ands or ors or wild cards, erasing all of that background and starting from scratch, you almost have an advantage if you don't have that background. You come in and you just ask it regular questions like you would a normal human being. So unlearning that has been a little bit of a task, but these people quickly pick that up once you show them the right way to do it.
Yeah, your anecdote there, Darth, is right on point. What I was going to say is I think it does take a relearning for those who are the Boolean search experts, but it's easy for them to relearn it because they tend to be tech savvy and appreciate the value of tools like this and like the fact that, you know, like conducting research and legal research and so on. Where I'm really seeing the biggest benefit, I think, to this new way of communicating is for the folks who are not as good at the Boolean searching, like the gentleman I mentioned at the beginning who hasn't done his own legal research in years and years because he liked it better when it was books. What he likes to do is be able to come in and pull an associate in the room and give this long-winded explanation about this case that he knows is out there about some topic that he thinks he sort of remembers what it was covered in the case, but he's not exactly sure. You could put that ramble into co-counsel and it will come up with a legal memo that has that case you're looking for. And I've had partners tell me that. They said, I spent 45 minutes trying to find this case using the other legal research tool that we have. And I couldn't find it. And then I put in my ramble into co-counsel and it knew what I was looking for and found it for me. So I think for those sort of attorneys who aren't great at knowing that it's parentheses, /3, close parentheses, /6, you know, some people are great at that, but you don't have to be for this. And I think it makes it a lot more approachable for attorneys from the most junior attorney to the most senior attorney. Can all jump in and communicate with it and get what they're looking for.
That's some library pillow talk right there.
Yeah, I was going to say, I love that.
Let me throw in one other thing, and because this is so great to hear about co-counsel being used like this, I'll throw in one place where there could be headaches coming, not insurmountable ones, but, you know, I remember in litigations, for patent litigation, like you could start litigating over what is the exact string that the other side has to use to look through their documents. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see what does the neural net sort of large language model prompting look like, where kind of fanciful things like artistic things like that says like, I'm a diligent researcher. You just tell the AI to sort of assume that and might impact the output. So it's going to be really interesting to see, you know, these sort of prompt wars that might happen in that context.
That is fascinating because it occurred to me one day, I wonder if you're going to give me, if your requests for production need to be run through this large language model on whatever data set of potentially relevant documents are identified one day, like that's a potential reality where the other side is getting to dictate the actual questions it wants to ask of your document set to try to find relevant documents. I mean, we really are the Wild West right now.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Wild West, I'm going to come back to you, Darth, here in a second with pretty much the same question, but Evan, how is this AI technology, I'm sure it's not just co-counsel, there's all kinds of other tools that are on the market. How is that just fundamentally changing the way that law firms are operating and offering their services out to their clients?
I think some things are changing, some things are staying the same. I think for years now, sophisticated clients like Darth have been expecting their law firms to do whatever they can to use technology appropriately, to do things more efficiently, to use technology to collaborate better. You know, there was a Wolters Kluwer survey that came out, I think, in October of last year that said something like 95% of all legal consumers, so companies and so on, that were interviewed, said that they specifically ask their law firms now what technology they use to do things more efficiently and to get better predictions and things like that. And I think it was 97% of them said they would specifically ask about that stuff, right? It was a month before ChatGPT came out, where the whole world now realizes, whoa, technology could do some amazing things. Mm-hmm. So I think we were already, I think the cat's out of the bag, we were already in a place where we know that as a law firm, unless we continue to push the envelope in using technology to do things in a better, smarter, faster, more efficient way, and better allocate our smart attorney brains on the tasks that are highest value for them, and try to use technology to get past some of the more mundane, busy work out of it, that we'll be in a better place and our clients are going to expect that. So I don't think that CoCounsel or generative AI has changed things. I think it has just massively accelerated the speed in which our clients will expect us to use technology like this to do things better. And I think the fact that Darth, who's a consumer of outside counsel, is on this call talking about the use of this, there are other in-house counsel out there as well that see the value of tools like this, know the value of it, and will start to expect that their law firms are using technology that's now available and safe and secure and accurate and helpful to help provide them better legal service. So I don't think this has fundamentally changed things. I think it's a super acceleration of it. And I think the law firms that see that will be better off because the clients appreciate it, and the clients will turn to them because they have tools like this at their disposal to help their already smart, already sophisticated, already expert attorneys be even better.
Darth, you know, earlier you talked about how, you know, AI technology was going to enhance, you know, lawyers' abilities and not replace lawyers. And I'm wondering if you can sort of share, like, you know, environmental specifics, you know, how the technology is altering the way that in-house legal counsel operates.
Can I add a sub question there? Because the biggest fear that I'm hearing from partners at law firms is that this kind of technology is just going to enable outside counsel to do their own work, to draft their own contracts, to do, you know, to have kind of start at point C instead of point A. Do you think that's something that maybe not now, but eventually will happen?
I mean, it could. Yeah. I mean, if you asked me 3 years ago where we were with this technology, I thought we were 10 years away from where we are now. Right. So I've walked back my predictions of the future. That being said, we are still going to need people who have relationships. We're still going to need people that can advocate on our behalf. We are going to need to know people that have a intimate understanding of the venue we're in, that are good with the local populations if they're picking juries. Will the work change? Probably. The work has always changed when emerging technologies have come out, right? But will the relationship overall change? And I don't think so. Workloads are increasing, right? Like, the amount of work isn't shrinking, it's growing. When the personal computer came out, everyone thought the work week was going to go to like 20 hours a week. I got my law firm laptop and I worked everywhere, on planes, on trains, the morning of my wedding. Like, there was no shortage of work. I think this technology will actually increase the amount of work that we're doing. We're going to be expected to do more and more and more, faster and faster and faster. And there's just no, you know, shortage of issues in the pipeline that, you know, are coming down. We can't get to some of our most important ones because we're stuck doing this low-end work.
Right.
So my idea is that this is going to kind of reposition me to take better advantage of my outside counsel and get them to higher-end work that is at their highest and best use instead of this low-end work that we unfortunately necessarily have to do. But, I mean, to Evan's point earlier, like, no lawyer went to law school so they could be the best or fastest copy and paste person, like, in their class. They went to law school to solve problems, right? So if we can automate to some extent the production of content and move lawyers to, you know, advocacy and counsel where they would rather, I think, be, we probably end up in a better place. So to that partner that says, well, you know, you're going to take away my contract, well, all right, I no longer need you to do the first draft, but I still need you to strategically think about the impact of this is upstream at this point. So you're not a single purpose lawyer. Get that out of your head. I know you've been doing it for a number of years, one specific thing, but there are better things you can probably do with your time right now. And trust me, we need our lawyers to be focusing on like high end stuff right now.
Yeah. who's going to be driving the change? Is it going to be the technology groups within, the innovation groups within the firm and the in-house counsel, or is it going to be demanded from the attorneys? Who's going to be driving the change, Evan?
I think it's both, and it depends on the firm. With something like this, I was privileged to have the opportunity to come to us from Pablo to work with them on this, and generative AI wasn't even known at that point to exist. So that in that case, it was the IT, KM, innovation, that sort of side. I think now, though, that this is out there and a product, and sophisticated clients like Darth know it's out there and other clients out there know it's out there, I think now it probably will be driven more by the clients and by the attorneys saying, hey, we need that too. Technology like that is going to help us and our clients expect it. But I think early stage with things like this, they're probably driven by the innovation, KM, IT type sides. But now that it's out there, I think the clients take over and start to say, we expect that from our firm as well.
Yeah, I agree with Evan. Early on, it is the early adopters of emerging technology that push it. And then tell everybody this is fantastic, and you get the same level of skepticism that you probably deserve because the last few things you put in front of them weren't earth-shattering. But with this, it really feels like there's a before and after. And I think to Evan's earlier point, people who were hardcore skeptics are easily converted after using it in a short amount of time. Working with Pablo and his team early on to help develop some of the features, I think interesting thing occurred when you start to get it in the hands of the practitioners. They start to use this stuff off-label, right? You develop a feature and you think they're going to use it a certain way, and then they repurpose it. And then you start to see like an evolution in how people are adopting and applying the technology. And I think that's what's coming next. So once this starts to go mainstream, I expect there to be compounding kind of evolutions in how people are using this, and so many creative use cases that I could probably never think of are going to emerge in a short time.
So speaking of creative use cases, we'd hinted a little bit earlier about how AI could or not sort of change relationships between law firms and in-house counsel. But in talking about these AI advancements, we're highlighting all of these different things that it can do, and that once we get this in the hands of some of the users, they're coming up with their own creative ways to approach this. Pablo, you're probably the best one to talk about this, sort of sitting between firms and in-house counsel and being a vendor. So can you talk about what impacts you might see on AI advancements on the relationship between those three entities? I'm thinking, again, some of the things that it can do could replace a lot of existing tools that we have, and that you might not have the need for as many as you do now.
That's the dream.
Yeah, there's a lot.
That's somebody's dream, not everybody's dream, though.
Yeah, no, there's a lot to that. I mean, I think one of the biggest differences with this new technology has been, I'm used to, I demo to a firm and somebody would see it and go, cool, I might bring my colleague in to, see it in 2 weeks. Now it's like you demo and they get all the managing partners rushing down like someone's been embezzling or something like that. And the kind of question that I get asked now is so qualitatively different. It's sort of like, well, what do I need to ask my client about using this? And I was like, oh, this is due like to be, consulted directly about how you should consult with your clients. Yeah, I think what there is right now is a lot of eagerness to learn about this tech and to start thinking about how do we navigate this stuff. And what I think companies like Casetext need to do, and what we have been doing, is trying to galvanize conferences, workshops, things like this podcast, to really start that discussion going. Because, whatever happens, it's very hard to predict what's going to happen with all of this. But the one thing that you sort of could predict is whatever happens is going to be what emerges from a bunch of conversations and thinking about it between these key stakeholders. But I will say this, that, lamenting that your client now has a more efficient way to do something is not in line with zealous advocacy. I'm sorry. Like, at the end of the day, ours is a profession, and we deliberately use grandiose words and concepts to describe how we're supposed to be devoted to our clients. So you should be happy that your client is now able to take care of some legal need without needing to spend more money or without needing to call you. And to Dart's point, right, that energy being sad about that would be much better spent focused on what are new things and new values that I can create for my client.
Yeah. Evan, I want to switch gears just a little bit here. And I know that everyone's wondering, how does this affect how lawyers are currently doing their jobs. I'm curious, do you have any plan for how you will introduce your summer associates this summer to technology like this?
It's certainly one of the tools that we'll train them on. We would like them to have access to it, to see how it works, just because we see that this really is going to be the way people practice law in the future. So we'd like them to get access to it right off the bat. One of the things, just in general, training anyone, I think, on this tool, if you have it available to your firm, you want to do that because that'll get the most use out of it, right? If it's something that you don't give them access to it, then they will know about it.
Following on that line, and Darth, can you discuss the importance of technology literacy for in-house legal teams and young lawyers who are just starting their careers?
Yeah, well, I mean, you have an ethical obligation to be technically competent, right? You have a duty of technological competence. I mean, it is what it is. It's codified in the vast majority of states. And you have an ethical obligation to give your client as an efficient, high-quality work product as you possibly can. You take that in line with where we are from a technological standpoint. I don't see how you can't use this technology to produce better work product faster, to better service your client. That being said, it's always been somewhat of a struggle in the legal industry to get people to up their skill sets in this area. Some of the beauty of this emerging technology is that I don't know that the skill sets are as important as they used to be. It really is almost, I don't want to say it's an easy button. There's still skill that goes into this, but it's much less skill is required. So I think for veterans who are shy to use the technology, they will feel more comfortable using it, to Evan's earlier example. And I mean, as far as new lawyers coming in, they're already using this. Law students are already using ChatGPT. I mean, it had 100 million users in 2 months.
Middle school is already using it.
I'm thinking about running their law school briefing through ChatGPT. You're crazy. They're going to come in probably with better techniques than us and lead the way. And they'll be happy to learn from them. Mm-hmm.
Good. Well, I want to talk about access to justice, which I think everyone knows is really important. And it's something that the industry, I think, has really fallen down on. We talk a big game, but we still have a big problem. And of course, when this launched, one of the first things that came out was, oh, finally, this is going to help with access to justice issues. So, Pablo, start with you. Do you think that a tool like this is not just going to help lawyers, legal information vendors, and in-house counsel when it comes to the legal needs of the whole community? What about, John and Jane Q. Public? How do you envision that they will benefit from resources like this?
All right, well, I'm going to start with John and JQ Prisoner for a second, because that's the one that we used, which is, the California Innocence Project was given access. We gave them access. And they have a backlog of people submitting, saying, look at my case. And what they told us is we were able to more quickly go through that backlog, right? There are more people that we're able to now evaluate to see which ones we think are being wrongly imprisoned, which I think is, that's access to justice, right? There are clinics right now that have lines that go around the corner. And if you are wealthy, your parents will just hire you a private lawyer and take care of things. If you're not, you better hope that you were in line early enough before they close the door and you have to wait 2 weeks for the next time for that to happen. So I absolutely think this is one of the most important things that can happen for access to justice, because it can increase the sort of throughput and the ability of people who have devoted their lives to helping the public, right? And for folks that don't have deep pockets, just do a lot more, right? To sort of amplify themselves. And that's something, Darth and I have been looking at a certain pro bono efforts around Ford. We're talking to the Harvard folks about their clinics. And I think that increasingly what you should see are folks devoting some of this capacity. For those in the private sector, I think we should all be, just as lawyers are supposed to give pro bono hours, I think those of us working with GPT-4 should give sort of server hours, if that makes sense, and make some of the capacity available, because it is sort of pricey right now, in order to help facilitate that kind of stuff. We should be profoundly ashamed if we do not use this revolutionary technology to make things, I'm talking the kind of difference you can see from space. It should be unrecognizable to us what some of these systems look like before, given what these tools can do.
Yeah. And you mentioned the California Innocence Project. They have a wonderful podcast that just launched a couple of weeks ago. The Legal Talk Network has that out. So if you haven't listened to that, that's a good listen of people doing good things out in for the public. So, Darth or Evan, do you have any comments on access to justice issues?
I mean, I think the technology can definitely assist us with access to justice. That being said, you know, technology wasn't the thing that held us back from it before.
It's not.
So we have to be intentional about how we do it. I mean, Pablo mentioned, you know, dedicating a certain number of server hours. You know, I would love for law firms and in-house legal departments to think about, you know, if you can quantify how much time is saved on a particular task because you leverage this technology, can you reallocate some of that to potentially pro bono? You know, if we're intentional about it, this definitely gives us a infrastructure to help. And to me, it's profound even if we reduce it 5%, right? Like 80% of people in civil justice matters don't have access to justice. That's a big deal. Like even an improvement, an incremental improvement utilizing technology is a win, but we need to reevaluate our priorities when it comes to this issue above and beyond the technology and make sure that we're being intentional about utilizing the technology to help in this area.
Okay, guys, so we're up to our crystal ball question. And this is where we ask you to look into the future and determine what challenges or changes you see in the next 2 to 5 years. So, Pablo, I will start with you.
All right. Well, you know, with all the normal caveats of how quickly this is moving, it's very difficult to make any predictions, but I'm going to hazard one. I think the big losers are going to be people who ignore this and hope it goes away or sort of cling to like an earlier system. I think second place is going to go to people driven by fear. And don't get me wrong, fear, doing this out of fear is much better than not doing it, right? It's much better for your outcome. But that'll just have you keeping up. And the people that do it from joy, and that might sound kind of cheesy, but the reason Darth and Evan were seeing this stuff way before was because they actually weren't just trying to like make sure they could keep up to the status quo. They were saying, how do we move the ball forward? How do we make things better than anyone is doing it? And if you take that approach to this technology and you see it for what it is, which is this just like amazing ability and capacity that is like almost infinitely flexible and can be pointed to so many different ways, those are the people that I think are going to thrive. And so, you know, I get it. At any given partnership, some people, maybe they'll only do it with the sort of Sputnik fear. That's fine. But I encourage folks to sort of quickly get past that and instead to realize what this is, which is just an amazing capacity to differentiate yourself, to create new client offerings, to just make everything a lot better. And those are the folks that I think are going to win. So perhaps not shockingly for me, I would say go forth with joy into this technology.
Excellent. I said that. I think that's good advice. Evan, what are your thoughts?
Sure. So, you know, I think you got three folks who are going to be positive on this one. So I think it's going to lead to happier clients. I think clients are going to appreciate having better predictability, better work product, better efficiency from their law firms. I think the lawyers themselves are going to be in a much better place, a lot happier, because they're able to spend more time doing the things that led them to want to go to law school in the first place, building those client relationships, using their really high-level strategic thinking rather than sort of the mundane aspects. And third, I think it's going to help folks like Darth's wife when her husband doesn't have to spend time on their wedding day doing that legal project because they were able to maybe get it done the day before using something like this. You know, a chance to get to see our kids for a couple extra minutes each day and our wives and so on. The whole practice will be better, right? It's always better when we could do things more efficiently and reprioritize where we should devote our time to. Clients are going to be better and our attorneys are going to be better as well.
Okay, well,
my wife is also a lawyer, and she probably worked the morning of our wedding as well. So,
you go.
So let's wrap up with your thoughts, Darth.
I think it's going to change everything to the point that we don't even notice it in 5 years. It's just baked into every single thing we do the same way I can't imagine life without email and the same way everyone freaked out when email first came out in the legal industry. My hope is that we see fantastic products coming down the pipeline that are well thought out, well secure. We have great practitioners that know how to utilize them that can service their clients better. And then we'll be on to the next advancement. This is rapidly evolving. So whatever my prediction is here and now will radically change in about 2.5 years. That's the upward trend we're on. I do believe this, though. The boat is leaving dock, and you can ride or you can swim. And if you decide to swim, you're probably not going to catch up. So now is the time to get on board.
Makes sense.
Also good advice.
Yeah. And as the great Yogi Berra said, predictions are really hard, especially when they're about the future. So, but Pablo, Evan, and Darth, I want to thank you all for coming on here today. I am sure we will be back with one or more of you in the near future to see how things are going with the tools. So thank you all for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
And of course, thanks to all of you listeners for taking the time to listen to the Geek & Review podcast. If you enjoy the show, share it with a colleague. We'd love to hear from you, so reach out to us on social media. I can be found at GayBauerM on Twitter.
And I can be reached on as Glambert on Twitter, if I can remember my handle again. and then we'll put everyone's where people can reach out to you on the show notes. So we'll take care of you guys.
Listeners can also leave us a voicemail on our Geek & Review hotline at 713-487-7821. And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry. All right, Marlene, I'll talk to you later.
All right, bye-bye.